Thank you. Yes, thank you for having me here today to give this talk. Very excited to talk about how a parity violation can occur in the early universe. So, to give a roadmap forward, I will be showing today two new constructions. So, by that I mean UV completions of dynamical Chern-Simons gravity, and these constructions will have a wide applicability to a range of EFT scales. I'll show that Chern-Simons gravity can give a parity violating primordial trispectrum that's large. I'll show that even in odd ratios of trispectra can contain direct information about spin. I will then quantify how well upcoming and future experiments can actually constrain such trispectra. And I'll finish by hinting to how parity violating trispectra can constrain baryogenesis. And there's a lot of jargon I've thrown up. But hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll know a little bit more of what I'm saying right now. So to begin, what is parity and how can gravity violate it? Parity in three dimensions acts to flip the sign of each component of a spatial coordinate vector x. So it goes x to minus x. When we speak of fields in three dimensions, parity splits them into two types of transformations. Those that transform under the plus sign, which are parity even fields, and those that transform under the minus sign, which are parity odd fields. When we speak of parity violation, we can first look at it just in a simple toy case of shapes in two dimensions. So if I have a disk, then parity actually isn't just encapsulated by a flip of the sign, but I need to actually specify some sort of axis. And if I flip something across this axis, I get the same shape, so this disk does not violate parity in any form. However, if I consider a lightning bolt and I flip it across, I do not obtain the same shape, so it does violate parity. When I speak of gravity violating parity, we should first think about what we mean by this. And so by that, gravity is described by gravitons, and gravitons, similar to photons, have two helicities, and they are parity inverses of one another. So if I have a counterclockwise helicity versus a clockwise helicity, if I just flip parity, I swap the two. And therefore, if they exist in the universe in unequal amounts, then I get parity violation. So if, let's say, the universe was filled with all left-handed gravitons, then that's a parity violating scenario. Phenomenologically, how this will enter into calculations later on is that it's going to be the degree of gravitational circular polarizability, so pi circ here. So it's just the difference of left-handed and right-handed gravitons divided by their normalized by the sum. Now, the question then is, how does one get a difference between left and right-handed graviton helicities? And the simplest answer to this case is Chern-Simons gravity. So what is dynamical Chern-Simons gravity? It's specified by the following actions. So here we first have the determinant of a space-time metric and Lorentzian signature, hence the minus sign. We have a pseudoscalar phi. We have the standard Einstein-Hilbert term that gives rise to GR. And then we have the main term of DCS gravity, which is this last one, and is specified by a coupling constant 1 over f, that's the DCS decay constant, as well as the Pontryagin density, which is a particular contraction of the Riemann tensor with itself, and specifically the Riemann tensor with its Hodge dual. And parity violation can already be somewhat seen at this level because of the presence of the Levi-Civita tensor here. If you do a parity violation, what sort of ends up happening is that two of the indices become flipped, and so you need to flip two of the corresponding Levi-Civita symbols, which picks up a minus sign, and then the pseudoscalar also picks up a minus sign, so that at least at the level of the action, it's all kosher. Now, this theory, as presented by this DC inverse decay constant f, this is an effective theory. So if I try to do scattering diagrams with this term, I will see that I obtain terms that are proportional to the energy of the system divided by f. And so if I have E over f be very, very large, then these terms will essentially blow up in a perturbative expansion. So this theory is effective. And the standard way to obtain Chern-Simons gravity is through the Green-Schwarz anomaly mechanism, and it gives rise to a DCSK constant that is of order the reduced Planck mass. So that is very large, and as a result, it means that astrophysical searches for Chern-Simons gravity don't really have as much hope, because, you know, if F is very, very, very big, like reduced Planck mass, then the effects of it are going to be highly suppressed. So the hope sort of in this first section is to like construct UV completions that are not the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation that give rise to F much smaller. And so, as I said, there are going to be two of such constructions. And so the first one is going to be through spontaneous symmetry breaking. The system that I'm going to be talking about is as described by the Lagrangian as written. So I have some Dirac fermion psi, and I have a complex scalar phi. The Dirac fermion has a mass that is indicated, say, a bare mass by M tilde, and the complex scalar field has a potential that has a U1 symmetry. These fermions and scalar fields also interact via Yukawa term, as written on the last. Now, below some energy scale capital F, you can expand this complex scalar field in polar coordinates, and this radial field will essentially describe deviations from this new vacuum configuration, because in the simplest cases, this potential takes something like the shape of a Mexican hat, and initially at high energy, you sit upon the top of the center of the potential, and then at low energies, you fall down to the minimum. Sigma here represents deviations from this vacuum along the radial direction, while the angular field shows deviations along this minimum. And so you can integrate out this scalar field sigma, so you don't need to think about it anymore. And when you integrate out the heavy scalar sigma, what you find is that this angular piece, A, is a massless scalar field that now has a pseudoscalar Yukawa coupling term with the fermion, as it inherits it from this previous regular Yukawa term, and that the mass of the fermion gets shifted accordingly. Now, this sort of pseudoscalar Yukawa term is the main workhorse to form Chern-Simons gravity, because I can then draw the following two diagrams. So just in terms of labeling, this dashed lines here represent the pseudoscalar A. The solid arrow lines are the fermions, and these wavy lines are gravitons. Now, the Lagrangian as written has not written down any, or does not display any interactions with gravity. However, you can sort of glean immediately how such interactions might arise. For example, in this contraction between the gamma matrix, gamma mu, and the partial derivative, you need one factor of a metric to contract the two. And so if you linearize around Minkowski, for example, then you pick up a factor of a graviton. So that gives rise to the bottom diagram, because you have this two fermion one graviton interaction occurring twice. But also you need to account for the fact that once you include gravitational interactions, you promote this regular flat derivative to a covariant derivative with a spin connection. And that induces a two graviton, two fermion interaction. And when you compute out what these terms actually correspond to, you precisely get Chern-Simons gravity. So G here actually corresponds to the pseudoscalar Yukawa coupling Y divided by square root 2. And by just simple rewriting, you can then identify the DCS decay constant as about 1,000 times the ratio of the mass of the fermion divided by the Yukawa coupling constant. And note that this mass now here is the total mass, which is the bare mass plus this correction.
So where is the Planck mass here?
Where is the Planck mass?
I mean, if Planck mass goes to infinity, there shouldn't be any coupling to graviton. So there should be a Planck mass somewhere here.
If Planck mass goes to infinity, then there shouldn't be any coupling anywhere. So what do I want to say to that?
Maybe you're setting it to 1 somewhere?
Yes. No, so it turns time into gravity. So that, I'll think about it for a bit and maybe get back to you later. But thank you. So yeah, this is essentially the first construction of Chern Simons gravity one can have. And because the mass of this fermion is essentially a free parameter, you can get a fairly wide range of scales you can do. You can go down to sub-EV, you can go larger than EV. It really is a wide playing field. The second construction of Chern-Simons gravity is somewhat analogous, and rather than spontaneous symmetry breaking, you will have dynamical symmetry breaking. So now the Lagrangian is as follows. It's that of a Dirac fermion C, usual, with a bare mass, and now there's some attractive fermion cell interaction for Fermi term. And similar to the Chern-Simons gravity, this is also an effective theory, because lambda has units of about of inverse energy squared or so. And there you have to supplant this theory with some additional cutoff capital lambda. But however, you can find simple UV completions such as a scalar interacting with some scalar mediator and through a Yukawa interaction, and then you integrate it out. The mediator to obtain this four Fermi interaction. Now, to sort of see that this actually gives rise to something similar as spontaneous symmetry breaking, we'll do the following analysis. So the four Fermi term can be represented diagrammatically as follows. And if I consider a higher order term, so I added a loop, then I also have this term. This also contributes to the four Fermi interaction because there are still four fermions. I can do this addition of interactions and so on and so forth in a geometric series. And if I do it in a geometric series, what I find is that there is similar to when I how do I see the presence of a new particle? Or I should say, let me back up one step. The goal of this process is to show that there is a bound state in the theory. And that bound state will be a complex scalar that undergoes spontaneous symmetry breaking. The way you can see a bound state is through this sort of schematic diagram. And the way we see we have a bound state is through the pole of some propagator. The reason why you can already glean sort of that there is a pole is because in a geometric series, you have 1 plus x squared, so on and so forth. That sums up to 1 divided by 1 minus x, and x has a pole at 1. In a similar case, if you do this analysis carefully, you find that there is precisely a pole at twice the mass of the fermion. And so this is sort of tells you that your theory has a bound state in it, but you sort of need to realize it more precisely. And the way that we do this is sort of via quasi-renormalization analysis. Now, again, because this is a bound state that is not immediately in your Lagrangian, you need to sort of tease it out. You can't just you don't see it right there. You need to do some field redefinitions and whatnot. So the way that we do this more precisely is first we multiply our original path integral by a constant. This constant is essentially a Gaussian integral over some auxiliary field alpha. And it has some coefficient m tilde squared that is there for technical purposes, but honestly does not change the answer at the end of the day. Once I multiply my path integral by this constant, I then split my fermions into long wavelength and short wavelength modes, where long and short are delineated or split according to some reference energy scale E. So long wavelength modes are going to have energies smaller than E, and short wavelength will have energies greater than E. And I define this complex scalar phi that is essentially a shift of this auxiliary field by the short scale modes. And then I integrate all short scale modes. If you do this carefully, what you find is that you obtain precisely the Lagrangian in the spontaneous symmetry breaking case with a Mexican hat potential, Yukawa interaction, still you get the four Fermi interaction, which is still there. And so because you get the same Lagrangian, you get the same type of dynamics of obtaining Chern-Simons gravity. So this also can give rise to Chern-Simons gravity. And one thing in this case is that because you're dealing with just a single fermion, you can actually imagine that this fermion is not necessarily a BSM particle, but it could be potentially a neutrino. So also to note that this Yukawa coupling constant is of order the attractive self-coupling constant times the cutoff squared. And so this fermion could be the neutrino, because neutrinos can have self-interactions that are fairly weak. And more precisely, additionally, the fermion, well, neutrinos have extremely low masses. And so since the DCS decay constant becomes smaller as the mass gets smaller, this has larger astrophysical signals.
Like maybe I'm missing something about mass Planck being equal to 1 again as well. Yeah. Is Wi-Fi being of order that? So like the first thing lambda, that's dimension. Oh, never mind. I see it's dimensionful because it's coming from your four fermion.
Yep. Okay. Yep. That's why. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right.
I guess that actually brings me to the other question I had looking at this.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of this sort of bound state is coming from that effective operator, right? Do I have to worry about that in sort of the path integral formalism here, that it's like I'm doing something, but it's over a non-renormalizable term?
So all these integrals that you evaluate off have a cutoff of this lambda. If you wanted to also entertain like a UV complete theory, for example, you want to say you have some just Yukawa type interaction with the mediator, you can, but those would be suppressed. The contributions of the UV complete theory to this in these terms would be suppressed by the cutoff energy of the integral divided by the mass of the mediator, which would be the cutoff of the theory. So I don't think you would need to worry too much about non-renormalizability or anything like that.
Can I quote something though?
Yeah.
If the bound state is at finite density and not then according to the work of Bolchinsky, that four fermion term now becomes a marginal operator and not an irrelevant operator in the argument. So
great. So we have Chern-Simons gravity. It can have a scale that is rather it can take a large range of values. It could be millielectron volt, it could be sub millielectron volt, it could be 10 to the 4 GeV. You can sort of take your pick depending on the model you choose. But how can I actually sort of see its effects on observables? So the first sort of ways you can look at it is by seeing how it modifies the waveforms of compact binaries. So if I have mergers of binary black holes or neutron stars, if I have the Chern-Simons term, the precise waveform of these mergers will deviate. You can also consider the birefringence of such gravitational waves. So if I have these gravitational waves emitted at the merger, they will travel through some medium. If that medium it happens to be the Chern-Simons scalar, then you will undergo birefringence of these waves. One polarization will be preferentially selected. And so that's another method you can use to sort of constrain Chern-Simons gravity. And then the third way is that it modifies orbits around Earth, because it changes, again, the equations of motion for objects since you're modifying gravity. Now, to note is that these types of observable signatures thus far have constrained F in the regime where it is extremely tiny. So the numbers you sort of see when looking at these papers are that F is of order 10 to the minus 50 EV and 10 to the minus 10 EV. And because the standard way of obtaining Chern-Simons gravity is through the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation, usually the only UV complete theory we've had thus far gives F of order reduced Planck mass. So now we have concrete models to actually be testing that where such observations are sensitive to. The other sort of class of ways you can look for DCS is by looking at primordial gravitational waves that are polarized, and then also looking at the imprints on galaxy clustering in the CMB. And so for the rest of this talk, I will focus, the first part should be thought of as like late time, and then all of these are early times, and I'll primarily be focusing on how DCS imprints itself on galaxy clustering. So how is galaxy clustering described? Galaxy endpoint functions. So here, when I'm saying endpoint functions, let's first talk about what object we want to sort of describe. We'll be speaking of the fractional overdensity field delta G, which describes deviations of the number density of galaxies at a position away from its mean density. This statistical field is described by its set of cumulants. So its one-point function, or its mean, is zero by definition. Its two-point function variance is can be reduced to a function of a single variable due to translation and rotational invariance. And by increase number of deltas, you can get an endpoint function, which is the cumulant of just n of these fields. Now, not all of these functions are useful in describing parity violation. In an isotropic universe, the lowest order endpoint function that can capture the effects of parity is, in fact, the four-point function. And the way you can think of this first is that if you have 2 points, let me place this down somewhere. If I have 2 points here, and if I did a parity inverse, and this is going to sort of hint to why it doesn't work immediately, but if I have 2 points, I can just rotate them back to each other. And so in an isotropic universe, rotations are valid symmetry transformations, and so that two-point function cannot capture any information about parity. If I try and go to the three-point function, let's look at these three, you know, points and do a parity flip to swap the orange and purple. Well, if I rotate it up the diagonal and then back around clockwise, I get the original configuration. And as a result, this does not capture any information about parity. The four-point function, however, if I add this green dot, I can try and do the same thing. I flip it. And then I rotate, but I see that I can fix these sort of blue and orange points, but I cannot. I get the opposite purple and green. And so, in fact, the four-point function is the lowest order correlator in an isotropic universe that encapsulates parity. Now, this is a description of the real space version. However, we'll be primarily working with its Fourier conjugate, the trispectrum, and the trispectrum is split, it's a, in general, a complex function, and the reality of the real space four-point function implies that the odd part of the trispectrum is precisely the imaginary part of it. Associatedly, the even part of the trispectrum is the real part of the full trispectrum. Now, this is all about galaxy clustering and whatnot, and I mentioned we'll be looking at inflation and how parity violation can arise in inflation. So as a quick review, I consider a period in the early universe where there is a scalar field phi that takes a largely homogeneous value phi naught at some initial time, and so it's and it has a potential v, and it just stays at this top of the potential. It slowly rolls down to the potential, where the slowly rolling is encapsulated and parameterized by the slow roll parameter epsilon, where over dot indicates derivatives with respect to cosmic time. As it slowly rolls, an accelerated expansion occurs, and this is great because this accelerated expansion solves three problems in cosmology: the horizon, flatness, and magnetic monopole problems. The horizon problem being that we see disconnected or causally disconnected patches across the sky, the flatness being that we see that the universe is spatially flat as far as we can see, and the magnetic monopole problem being that gut theories often want to produce a large amount of magnetic monopoles. How does one get rid of it? By having accelerated expansion of the universe at early times, any magnetic monopoles will be quickly diluted. Any curvature would also be quickly diluted, and you essentially have more time for the initially causally disconnected pieces to sort of rejoin and talk to each other. What's also great about inflation is that it sort of seeds initial density perturbations. And so it's not just that this is slowly rolling, it also has some quick fluctuations about this slow roll. And these fluctuations then seed the galaxy overdensities that I mentioned before. Now, in the context of inflation, what is Chern-Simons gravity? So let's go back to the metric. The metric is now expanded across about an FLRW universe with some graviton, Hij. It's a transverse traceless object. You will identify the DCS pseudoscalar as the inflaton. And then everything else is sort of the same. Now, as I mentioned before, there is usually a potential. However, it slowly rolls down this potential, and so I have not written it down explicitly. However, if the potential is roughly constant and parameterized by some constant to the fourth power for unit agreement, then the scale of this potential when Hubble is about 10 to the 14 JeV takes about the value of 10 to the 16 JeV. So to note that this value here is, this fiducial value is taken because in single field slow roll inflation, that tends to be the highest value of Hubble you can entertain based on current experiments. Now, given this action, we want to compute the primordial trispectrum because that's the lowest order statistic that can describe parity violation. So rather than four pieces of galaxies, we're going to be talking about four pieces of inflaton perturbations. And the dominant contribution to this correlator is a diagram as follows. So this solid black line indicates conformal time tau equals zero, i.e. today. And when you go below this line, you're going into the past. Each of these points indicates one of the inflatons. And the solid lines indicate propagators of the inflaton. The inflaton interacts with gravity through the graviton H, and so there's this interaction term that's 3 points. The way that you get this interaction term is actually built into the theory, or really any theory of a scalar, because if I look at the kinetic term of the perturbed inflaton, I see that, you know, expanding out g mu nu to linear order, you would get for free a cubic interaction between the graviton and the inflaton through this sort of derivative coupling. Now, without doing any math, you can already somewhat see that the answer at the end of the day should look something like a power spectrum of the inflaton, well, two copies of the power spectrum of the inflaton, as well as a power spectrum of the graviton. And the way you can see this is because I have two pairs of inflatons. A power spectrum is a two-point correlation function, so I have one correlation function here, one right here. And then I also have a single graviton in the intermediate regime, and so I get one factor of this graviton power spectrum. Now, what I have not said at all, though, about this diagram is its momentum configurations. And so while I've drawn only one diagram here, there are actually three. And you know, similar to like a 2-to-2 scattering in standard Feynman diagrams, you have the ST and U channels. And they are described by these three ordered lists of vectors. So the way you should be reading these ordered lists is that as I move left to right in this list, I move left to right in the labeling of these inflatons. And these are ordered in such a manner such that the sum of their first two components is equal to the negative sum of the last two components, which is equal to the Mandelstam variable k sub I. Now, one thing that's sort of nice about this definition and whatnot is that you can sort of also visualize the momentum in the following diagram. So due to translation invariance, the sum of all of these momentum must equal zero, which means that in this picture, they must form a closed loop. And since I have four momentum, it's going to be some quadrilateral. And in order to describe this, let me first describe what these axes are. So E1, E2, and E3 are rotations of the X, Y, and Z axes, the standard. And the rotation matrix used is a channel-dependent one, so you have a different rotation matrix for each channel, ST and U, and it's defined so that the z-axis aligns precisely with the Mandelstam variable direction. So that's why this pink vector right here sort of lies along E3. And a general configuration is such, you just have them sort of lying about them as follows. With this primordial scalar trispectrum, we've computed what its shape is, we've computed its amplitude. More precisely, we also computed with it the associated curvaton, or not curvaton, but curvature power spectrum, which is linearly related to the inflaton. This primordial curvature is what seeds the potentials with which galaxies grow in at later times, and so it is observable of interest to actually calculate. Now, I will not demonstrate or show, unless you ask me, what this full calculation looks like, because it is not really insightful to stare at. A more insightful calculation is to look at this in the collapsed limit. Yes?
I just wanted to ask some questions about the choices you made here for sure. K-values, but I think you just said collapsed, so you're going to tell me the answer.
So I'll say right now, we did calculate it without making any choices for k-values, but I'll just show right now, I'll talk about the collapse limit for now. So for the collapse limit, what do I mean by this? It says that each of the momentum of the inflaton are much larger than the internal momentum propagator of the graviton. What this implies for the magnitude, values of the magnitudes of these momenta is that essentially the first two momentum are equal and the last two momentum are equal. And in the picture drawn before, essentially, because you're taking the graviton momentum to zero, you're just squashing the diagonal. And you can sort of see there that, you know, K1 and K2 are approximately the same, and K3 and K4 are approximately the same. So what is the trispectrum in this limit? So once again, we've switched from inflaton perturbations to curvature perturbations, and the real and imaginary parts of the trispectrum correspond to the parity, even and parity odd pieces. The superscript GE here is to emphasize that this is the trispectrum as a result of graviton exchange. In the parity odd sector, this is the leading contribution. And we are specifically taking the collapse limit where the k sub I Mandelstam variable is going to zero. One needs to make a choice between one of the three. And what we find is that, just as we expected, the parity even and parity odd parts are proportional to two copies of a scalar and one copy of a graviton power spectrum. And the reason why there's one copy of a graviton power spectrum is because I have the tensor to scalar ratio R here multiplying one of these, and so that gives you a tensor power spectrum, which is precisely the graviton power spectrum. Now, there's also these angular factors, cosine 2k and sine of theta 1i. The thetas are the zenith angles when embedding the momentums into spherical coordinates. Chi sub I is a slightly more complicated angle. So once again, we have this quadrilateral that exists. And if I split this quadrilateral into these two pieces of two pairs of momentum vectors, each of them define a plane, assuming they're not degenerate, and they therefore have an associated normal vector to them. If I take the dot product of those two normal vectors, that angle chi sub I is the angle that describes that. Now, it's sort of nice to also show that in pictures what the angular configurations are that maximize these trispectra. So on the left is the parity even, and on the right the parity odd. So the way you should be reading these pictures is that, you know, this is again the first and second and third momentum of one angular configuration where this chi sub I is equal to zero here. And then each line style of these other three and four configurations have rotations that are indicated by the corresponding line style underneath it. So, you know, this dashed one is about pi over 2. This dotted one at the end is by pi, analogously for the parity odd piece. And what you can see sort of here is that they're slightly shifted off because, well, one of them is proportional to cosine and one is proportional to sine. One thing also to point out is that the parity odd piece is proportional precisely to this degree of gravitational circular polarization, pi circ, as mentioned at the beginning. So if you have zero differentiation between left and right helicities, then you don't have any parity violation in your theory. Now, one thing that's also you might be picking up on by looking at these, they look rather similar. And if you take the ratio of the odd trispectrum to the even trispectrum, it is precisely this degree of gravitational circular polarization times some angular factor. And this factor 2 here is by no means an accident. It is a factor 2 because the graviton is a spin 2 particle. And the way you sort of can see this possibly is that the polarization matrices used to describe gravitons can be represented as a product of two spin 1 polarization vectors. And essentially, since you have two copies of that, a two appears here. Now, what you might also be seeing from this trispectrum is that it's proportional to the tensor to the scalar ratio R. And the tensor to the scalar ratio is rather small. It is less than about 0.04 or so, according to Bicep. And so if you just take standard DCS gravity, you will not be able to see it. So in order to sort of go beyond standard DCS gravity, one can parameterize the collapse limit by multiplying it by some amplitude.
Just yeah. One point. So here you're just computing the contribution of, graviton interaction to the four-point function.
Yep.
There's probably a bigger contribution from just the scalar-scalar interactions.
So not in the parity odd sector.
Right, but in the parity.
In the parity even sector, it's actually been shown before that the graviton contribution dominates over the scalar contribution.
Over a scalar-scalar?
Yes. Yep. Okay. Yes.
We like this for a single field.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So in order to go beyond standard DCS, we parameterize it by this constant factor, capital F. And what I'll show now are two examples beyond this vanilla case that can give rise to F that are fairly large. So the first is one with a superluminal scalar sound speed. So I just take my vertex interaction that I had before, and I multiply it by C sub s squared, and C sub s is greater than 1, and so these just become stronger at the end of the day. Precisely, f in these cases is proportional to its 8th power. You can sort of see how you can get such a large power immediately from this diagram. You know, C sub s squared pops up here, so that's one factor. C sub s squared is here, so that's c to the 4th. The other four factors come from rescaling of conformal time integrals and power spectra. But essentially, if you have a modestly superluminal scalar sound speed, you can get a very large enhancement compared to the standard DCS case.
Sound speed also applied to the graviton too, right?
So if we're talking about, this is the scalar sound speed. You can entertain a graviton sound speed that changes as well. We didn't consider it in the paper, but yeah, you can consider scale. Graviton sound speed changes. There's many ways. This is only meant to be two examples. They're not an exhaustive list. You can consider solid inflation. You consider non-Bunch-Davy vacuum initial conditions, so on and so forth.
Yeah, if this takes it too far off topic, I'll just ask you about it afterwards. But it seems to me that if I talked about this in terms of inflationary perturbations,
yeah,
standard theory there, mm-hmm. What you calculated is what they might call like tau and out, or when
yeah. Somewhat, yeah, for the parity even sector, yes.
And then for the parity odd sector, yeah, you don't usually calculate that because it vanishes.
Can I add something? This is for maybe the Irish to hear. This need not only happen for inflation.
Yeah.
Well, with different momentum configurations, you might calculate something more like G and L, where you're, instead of enforcing this condition that you're enforcing, what you call a Mandelstam variable, Instead, you're just going to a more general momentum configuration where they all just have to sum to zero. Was there a reason that going there didn't help with this analysis? Or?
So the general question, if I'm understanding correctly, is why we're looking at the collapse limit, really? And it, would going to other configurations be better? The collapse limit was primarily chosen for its simplicity. In the limit of zero graviton momentum, essentially all additional factors of momenta due to graviton drop out. And it, in particular for the second case of quasi-single field multi-field inflation, we're changing sort of the interactions between the graviton and this isocurvature field sigma. And that adds a lot of different momentum dependencies, and we didn't want to go through the whole detail of calculating what the full tri-spectrum is for such an example. But when you take the collapse limit, any interactions between the graviton and this isocurvature field drop out because you're taking that momentum to be zero. And so it just enters in as this constant factor. So in terms of the why this collapse limit was chosen, it is the case that it was just done for simplicity. There are configurations that are much larger than, not say much larger, but that are larger than the collapse limit. For example, in the if you look at the parity even case, it's already known that a softly squeezed limit can generate a slightly larger parity even trispectrum. And that contributes to the GNL. However, no one knows actually where the graviton trispectrum peaks. It's just not known. Going to this quasi-single field, multi-field inflation case, just to say, what you have now is an interaction that induces essentially a mixing between this isocurvature field sigma and the inflaton. And then you also have the gravitational interaction. And the reason why you can get such larger enhancements in this case is because you don't have the restriction that this isocurvature field is slowly rolling, so its potential can just lead to larger enhancements. And in this case, this W here has been computed in this paper, and essentially it can take values between like 1 and 20 or so. And when it's 20, you can get amplitude enhancement factors of 10 to the 4. However, that's assuming that this isocurvature field is slightly massive. If you go into the like sort of the fully massless limit, then you can get up to enhancements of about, you know, 10 million or so, if I'm doing the math correctly in my head. So to just say that these trispectra can be large in models beyond DCS, standard DCS. But even though this is large relative to the standard case, does large mean detectable? And what I want to say now is that, in fact, yes. So we have the parity. What this sensitivity analysis is going to be only for the collapsed trispectra. But let's say we want to talk about both parity even and parity odd components. Then this Kronecker delta here will tell us if we're going to be looking at the sensitivity to the parity even, in which case this piece is zero, or parity odd, in which case this is just pi circ times r. The reference scale, again, is 0.04 because that is the largest that R can be according to BICEP. Now, we are going to look at how sensitive we are at 3 sigma. So this N is the degree of strength of the signal. We will have a fiducial, if you have a fiducial value of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 or so, and you measure 10 to the 6 linear modes between a minimum wave number of 0.003 inverse megaparsecs to 0.3 at a maximum wave number, then you can actually get this type of 3 sigma signal. If you specify to the parity odd component and you plug in for the functional form for what the degree of circular polarization is in terms of the DCS decay constant, we find that these decay constants need to be about less than 10 to the 9 GeV in order to get a 3 sigma signal. In order to do a slightly more sophisticated analysis, we also modeled these number of linear modes by actually taking consideration the volume of the probed experiment, the fact that, well, to back up one moment, the types of experiments we were considering are both spectroscopic galaxy surveys and 21 centimeter experiments. And 21 centimeter experiments have large foregrounds that essentially force you to cut out modes along the beam. And so to account for this factor, you have this wedge cut W here that is set to 1 for spectroscopic galaxy surveys. We account for the mode decorrelation due to nonlinear structure formation at late times in this propagator G squared, and the presence of shot and thermal noise in this Poissonian term at the bottom. And if we try and use this formalism to talk about actual experiments rather than general sensitivity, the main thing that we sort of see is that for current and upcoming and futuristic experiments in both 21 centimeter at the bottom and galaxy surveys at the top, you need amplitude enhancement factors of about 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 or so to get a 3 sigma signal. You can sort of see that 21 centimeter experiments aren't necessarily doing as well as galaxy surveys, and that's primarily because of this wedge cut. And to sort of be optimistic and pessimistic, we've considered two minimum values for the wave number in these experiments and corresponding to the left and right pieces in these couplets. So that's just to say that, well, going back to the models we wrote down earlier, 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 and amplitude enhancement factors are, in fact, fairly reasonable within those two examples. And so you can actually get detectable Chern-Simons gravity out of these theories.
Question.
Yes.
So Oliver may describe, and did another group, that there is some parity odd component in galaxies.
Yes.
What pi circ would that translate to?
So it's a lot of parameters, but I'll say the following. If you have a pi circ of order unity, then you have a DCS decay constant of 10 to the 9. For Oliver's paper, he mentioned there was a 3 sigma detection, you need then an amplitude enhancement factor beyond standard DCS of about 10 to the 6. For Jamin and Robert and Zach, they reported a 7 sigma detection, so you would need to multiply this by 7, and then correspondingly divide or make this also a factor of 7 times, or 7/3 larger.
But what would the pi circ be?
Order unity.
They're both pi circ of order unity?
Yeah, so pi circ is a backup slide that I have so that you can just see the functional form explicitly.
The pi circ was the ratio of the odd-even, right?
Yes.
And I couldn't tell what is the ratio of odd to even from that paper.
100%.
Here.
Yeah. 100% is the ratio of
right here. Here's pi circ in terms of the functional parameters. So it depends, you know, square root of epsilon because of the slow roll parameter. I'm going to get rid of these closed captions. Apologies. So if you have Hubble occurring at 10 to the 14 JeV with a slow roll parameter that's consistent with N sub S and a DCS decay constant, which is 10 to the 9 JeV, you get order unity pi circ.
Okay, but is that consistent with what he is claiming? Is pi circ of order 1? That's because I was claiming something smaller than that. But I guess
so pi circ has to be between minus 1 and 1 by definition. And so at most, it can be 1. And so what I'm showing here is that it is reasonable to obtain pi circ close to 1 with values of inflation that are consistent with single field slow roll paradigm. Yeah?
I guess I kind of have a question, like, when I see something like this, I can rescale the parameters.
Yeah.
Obviously, I can't rescale F too far below what it is right now, and because the thing on the left is going to saturate at 1.
Yeah. So this is the linear order piece. There's higher order terms that force it to saturate at 1. Yes. Going back to the initial thing. So that's all to say, once again, it is potentially detectable. Wonderful. So I've also mentioned I want to give hints to lepto and baryogenesis. And so in order to talk about this, I will sort of focus in on this Chern-Simons term and emphasize that this Chern-Simons term coupling to the pseudoscalar here is only dependent on conformal time tau, or just time in general. So This is the Chern-Simons. The Pontryagin density is a total derivative, similar to how FF dual is a total derivative because it's a topological term. And since I'm only a function of tau here, when I integrate by parts of this derivative term, it only picks up the time derivative piece. So really, this is a derivatively coupled scalar to some current. And if I do some quick algebra, then what I see is that this sort of coupling constant almost to the Pontryagin density takes the form of a chemical potential mu, where this chemical potential mu here is defined in terms of these square brackets. And the reason I want to draw the analogy with the chemical potential is that via the chiral anomaly, I see that if I have additional fermions in my theory, that the zeroth component of the chiral anomaly, which is the only dominant component when we're talking about just time-dependent effects, is a difference between left and right-handed chiralities of this fermion. And it's proportional to this Chern-Simons term. So if I go back and plug in this expression for the difference of left and right chirality fermions into this Chern-Simons term, and I do some canonical normalization, what I find is that this term actually is rewritten as the chemical potential times the difference between left and right-handed fermions. And this is precisely, again, to verify that this is actually a chemical potential. What's a chemical potential? It biases the production of one particle species over another. If I have hydrogen, you know, and I'm at temperatures below the binding energy of hydrogen is, you know, 13.6 eV, then I would preferentially produce hydrogen over having electrons and protons. But here, if I have essentially at energies below this chemical potential, I would biasly produce left over right-handed fermions. And if you produce left-handed fermions over right-handed, you're producing a net lepton number. And that net lepton number can be converted into baryon number at a later point due to Sphaleron transitions. So that's just to say that these models that we've written down sort of already can give rise to baryogenesis through leptogenesis. And so if you're able to probe the parity-violating trispectrum, you can actually start constraining such models since they automatically do leptogenesis for free for you. So to sort of go over what I've said then thus far, or to conclude really, I've shown two constructions of Chern-Simons gravity that can give a wide range of decay constants. We've shown essentially the first example of a massless spin exchange giving rise to parity-violating scalar trispectrum. These trispectra can probe DCS at a very high value. So remember the F that was written in order to get an order unity degree of gravitational circular polarization, pi circ, is about 10 to the 9 GeV or so. This is to contrast with gravitational wave experiments where the scales of F being probed there are of like 10 to the minus 50 eV, 10 to the minus 10 eV. So that is to say, large scale structure and the CMB can probe Chern-Simons gravity in an uncharted regime compared to standard analyses. And moreover, we got this like fun fact that if you take the ratio of an odd to an even trispectrum, you can get direct information about the spin. And what this is nice is that you sort of can get like a model independent way of seeing how parity violation can arise. So let's say I was able to detect both the parity even and parity odd pieces of the trispectrum, and then I could take their ratio. If they happen to have in the collapse limit this sort of rapidity of the angle by a factor of two, I know that a graviton is mediating that interaction. While if I saw it was a factor of one, I know it's some U1 field instead. And that's nice because it also gives like a nice way of detecting how potentially baryogenesis can occur at high energies. And I'll leave my extensions in, on there and just take any questions to finish.
Very much for the presentation. Any questions?
Well, so just to be clear,
yes.
So were you or were you not trying to account for the Boss claim detection using models like this?
So I would say initially we were trying to see if we could account for this detection. We have not run an analysis explicitly to see if it does. But also given the recent paper of the CMB, yeah, so from Oliver, yeah, precisely. It seems unlikely and it's more likely that it's systematics. However, I would still say even outside of the scope of whether or not such a model can explain this signal or systematic, which seems like it is, you can still use it as a interesting tool to constrain baryogenesis.
Is there any construction you can think of that would produce a signal in?
So this is the question. Yeah. So this is something Stefan and I were talking about. Can you, because yeah, at the end of the day, you know, the CMB is photons and large scale structures, galaxies. You can imagine having some washout effect in the photons that doesn't exist in large scale structure. I don't think we've come to any potential like conclusive models. However, yeah, that is a.
Can I say something speculative? It's speculative because I don't understand it, but also Jim Peebles came to me. I gave it a less impressive talk than Cyril did, but he was there at that talk, and he came up to me and goes, "You know, I never understood galaxy spin."
Galaxy
spin.
Spin.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, I was like, "But you wrote the paper on it." But yeah, so anyway, I'll just leave it. You know, yeah.
Move what? Moving the ghost. Ah, yes. Yeah, the first extension.
I like those.
Yes. So one fun or annoying fact, depending on who you talk to, about Chern-Simons gravity is that it has a ghost. This is due to essentially the presence of higher order derivatives in the Chern-Simons term. So the Chern-Simons term is quadratic in the graviton. So let me see if I have a formula for it. Let's see, I think it's in here. Woo. From the side. So at the top, what you're seeing is precisely what this Pontryagin density looks like, and you have three factors of derivative here. So for large values of the momenta, because this is a quadratic piece, it can actually make the kinetic term go negative. So this tends to be annoying for some. This is also actually a reason why we sort of looked at the collapse limit, is because if you take the graviton momentums to be soft, you're not worried at all about exciting this ghost piece because the momentums are small. And one thing is that if you remove the ghost, is that you can then consider the full general shape of the primordial trispectrum due to the graviton exchange.
But still, I mean, since it's not, you know, it's not an external state in the diagram, you shouldn't worry about it. It's off shell.
I mean, if you take your momentum values to be large, it does, because then you don't know what your initial conditions are. If your modes are initially ghost-like, it becomes, the analysis is really confusing. That being said, I don't believe that this term necessarily is actually indicating anything like potentially sick about the theory or whatnot. It just means you need to add more terms because, you know, this is an effective theory, and so it should go away when you go to an actual UV complete theory. So one thing I'm going to do is like actually compute what those additional terms are needed to remove this ghost out. But given that we were all our results rely primarily on the collapse limit where the gravitons have very small momentum, that shouldn't change anything about those results. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Okay, if there's some,
yeah. Good question.
Yeah.
So it seemed like part of the setup here for at least one of the models was to create a bound state for fermions.
Yeah.
And you did that with an effective coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any reason not to just like put an additional scalar field in theory and
just to do it for the UV complete?
Yeah.
Generality, because then you can consider a variety of different UV theories because there are multiple. So one was the Yukawa, another one that you can write down. Let's see, UV completions. Is that what I have right here? This one. There we go. So here are two different UV completions you can have for the attractive potential. And so we just wanted it to be general so we could consider both cases or even more cases beyond this.
Is that UV completion enough to help with the Chern-Simons ghost problem, or is that a
So this is precisely one of the things I want to do, is essentially just take this UV complete theory right here and just compute out what additional terms are to cancel out the ghost. That it's a very straightforward thing, as you point out. But yeah. I don't know the answer. I mean, I know the answer is yes, because like this theory has no ghosts in it. This is scalar Yukawa theory. There's no weirdness going on. So the fact that there's a ghost popping out is just like there needs to be an additional term. But yeah.
So where is the parity violation in this theory? I don't see. Is it somewhere else that there was parity violation?
So yeah. So this comes about. So this is. Again, this, oh gosh, let me go all the way to the beginning. So the theory we're thinking about is this one here. Here is, the way to be thinking about this. The four Fermi interaction term here has a chiral symmetry. But once you form the bound state and you get these Yukawa interactions, you no longer have it. And so you are spontaneously breaking effectively a PQ symmetry. And so you are developing an axion that's a pseudoscalar. That's essentially what why there is this parity violation term that comes about.
And the other theory, there was brought parity here. It's the left and right. You're thinking differently. Okay.
Yeah.
That one is
No problem.
Okay, I think we can thank Cyril again. Yes.